Hare Krishna. Welcome back to the Mahabharata character series. We continue with our discussion on Bhishma. In the last session, we discussed about how Bhishma stayed firm and the dynasty was continued through Vyasadeva with the birth of Dhritarashtra, Pandu and Vidura. Now, as these three princes were growing, Bhishma continued to very competently rule the kingdom of the Kurus, and the Kurus were established as the emperors of the whole world because there was no warrior who could match Bhishma. And as both Pandu and Vidura, Vidura, because he was born of a Shudra and he was never eligible to become the king, but he was a very learned minister and he became very dear to Bhishma also as a close friend and as a trusted minister in the assembly. And as both of them grew up, Dhritarashtra and Pandu, the two princes, because Dhritarashtra was blind, he was older among the two brothers, but still he could not become the king. So Pandu eventually became the king. And now Bhishma, again, because he was the father figure, their father was Vyasadeva, their father was actually Vichitravirya, who had departed, and Vyasadeva was surrogate father. So he was not involved in their direct upbringing. So now he started thinking about how to arrange for their marriages. So he went to he decided to go to various places. So he went to Kandahar in Afghanistan, and there was the king and he had a daughter named Gandhari, and he asked for her hand in marriage. And then he said that I want her hand in marriage for the Kuru princes. Now the Gandhar king agreed. Now Gandhari had a brother, Shakuni, and Shakuni came with Gandhari. Just as when the bride comes to the bridegroom's place at that time, often just to make her feel comfortable, the brother also comes along sometimes. So she came along. Now what was expected was, or Shakuni had expected, was that Gandhari would be married to the prince who would become the king. He had expected her to be married to Pandu. When Bhishma, this was the first princess to be brought. And Bhishma thought that the older among the two brothers is Dhritarashtra. So naturally, the older brother should get married first. And that's why he asked Gandhari to get married to Dhritarashtra. And when Gandhari heard about this, she was, as the Mahabharata goes forward, we'll see what an extraordinary lady she was. She accepted it as the will of providence, and she thought that a wife should not be superior to her husband in any way. So if my husband does not have eyes, then I should also not have eyes. And therefore she put a blindfold on her eyes, and she never took off that blindfold. She actually took it out only once, just before, on the 17th day of the war, on that evening. She actually took that to, not on the 17th day evening, 18th morning, just before the final day of the war, she took it out. Took out the blindfold to glance upon Duryodhana and imbue his body with an invincible strength by which nothing could break him down. So we'll discuss that when we come to it. But the point right now is she covered her eyes completely. And in this way, she is an emblem of chastity. So here, Gandhari became married to Dhritarashtra. But unfortunately, Shakuni, when he saw this, he felt that not only has his sister being wronged, but he felt he himself had been wronged. And not only he himself had been wronged, but the whole Gandhar dynasty had been wronged. And he decided that I have to take revenge. And the way to take revenge is that I will ensure that if my sister cannot become the king, the queen, then at least her sons will become the kings. And that's how Shakuni's envy towards the Pandavas was triggered. Now here we see that sometimes attachment can pervert people in such ways. Now Gandhari, we don't see in the Mahabharata, she ever craved for the kingdom or she craved to be the queen. She accepted what is the will of providence. But actually through Gandhari's marriage to the Kuru prince, it was Shakuni who had been having a lot of expectations. So actually frustration is a function of expectation. The greater our expectation, the greater will be our frustration. And the greater our frustration, the greater will be the fury that comes when there is frustration. So Shakuni's fury came out as his evil scheming, by which he completely perverted Duryodhana, who already had evil tendencies. And that's how this became the womb through which the whole destruction of the Kuru dynasty would eventually take place. So later on, Bhishma decided that he needed, queens were needed for Pandu also. So then he went to the Swayamvar of the Yadu dynasty and got Kunti from there. So actually, Kunti had been born to Surasen, who was Vasudev's father. So there is Vasudev, above him is his father's generation is Surasen, and then from Vasudev came Krishna. So now, because Vasudev and Krishna were brother, Vasudev and Kunti were brothers, so Krishna is the nephew of Kunti and Kunti is his aunt. But after she was born, her birth name was Prutha. But Surasen, he was a very close friend with another king. That king was Kunti Bhoj. And Kunti Bhoj did not have children. So that's why Prutha's father, that is Surasen, gave his daughter Prutha, Kunti, Prutha to her, to his friend's family, that is to the family of Kunti Bhoj. And because he gave the family to Kunti Bhoj, then she was living there, and for her to suddenly leave her mother and father and go away was difficult. But she agreed and she went there, and she was living with Kunti Bhoj as his daughter. And because she lived with his daughter, with him as his daughter, she got another name, Kunti. So Bhishma went to Kunti Bhoj and he asked for the hand of Kunti for the Kuru princess. So Kunti Bhoj agreed. He said, it's honor for us. And then Kunti came and she was married to Pandu. Then Bhishma thought that actually, to ensure that the dynasty goes on, it is better that the king has not one but two queens. So in the Vedic culture, polygamy was an accepted part. The purpose of polygamy were manifold. One of the most important purposes was to ensure that all women got the protection of a husband. In the Vedic culture, it often happened that sometimes the number of women, the female children who were born, would be more than the male children. So then, if there were no polygamy, then some females would remain unmarried. Secondly, it would also happen that some males would become renunciates. So if they become renunciates, then the number of males available for marriage would also decrease. And moreover, it is also recognized that Kshatriyas have passion. Generally, there is passion within the male body, and especially in the Kshatriya body, there is a lot of passion. So Kshatriyas, they are allowed by the laws given in the Vedic scriptures to have many wives. So the Vedic culture is not against passion. There is regulation of passion within the sanctity, within the sacred bounds of dharma. So a king can have many queens, but the king is expected to very responsibly and lovingly take care of all the queens. And as long as the king can do that, then he can have many queens also. So the important point was that Vedic culture, women were properly protected, and women and men were also provided the opportunity, if they have a lot of desires, to fulfill those desires within the precincts of dharma. So Bhishma thought that there should be some other queen also. And therefore, he went to the king of Madras, who was at that time Shalya, and he asked that his sister, that was at that time, the king was their father, but he was not there. Shalya was the king, and he asked for his sister, that is Madri, that she, for her hand in marriage. So now Shalya said, I am honored by this, but then we have a different custom. He says, in our tradition, the custom is that when a girl is to get married, the boy's family should give gifts to the girl's family. And only then can we give our girl in marriage. Now, actually, in one sense, this is the opposite of the dowry system. The dowry system normally is that the girl's family gives some gifts to the boy's family. And there are many people who say that the Vedic culture led to the many evils in the name of dowry. And that unfortunately happens today, wherein marriage often becomes like a business where the male is auctioned to the highest bidder from the female family. And not only is it's like an auction, but afterwards also it's like an extortion business where sometimes the girl's family are expected to give more and more money, and money is made into a demand. Otherwise, the women are tortured, the wife is tortured, and unfortunately sometimes some bridal burnings also happen. Now, this is an extreme distortion. The original concept in Vedic culture was that the money that was given at the time of bride, at the time of dowry, that was considered to be the belonging of the daughter. And that was of the daughter who was going to become a wife. And that was her security, financial security. Normally in the Vedic culture, it was such that when the father passes on his legacy, the inheritance, the property is not inherited by the woman directly. The property goes to the men, the male children. But that does not mean that the woman is bereaved of entirely. No, at the time of her marriage, she gets a lot of dowry, and that dowry becomes her property. And actually, the jewelry and the other property that comes, that even the husband cannot take it without his wife's permission. So the tradition would be that a father would give this dowry money to his daughter at the time of marriage, and the daughter would get married, and that jewelry and all such money, all such wealth would stay with her throughout her life. And eventually when she would have a daughter and her daughter would get married, she would pass on this dowry money to her. So dowry in Vedic culture was neither exploitative nor mandatory. It was not exploitative that the money was being extorted by the male from the female. No, it was not exploitative. It was a matter of passing on the family legacy and giving a gift of love to the daughter who was going to a different house now. So it was not exploitative, and nor was it mandatory. Non-mandatory means it was not that marriages could not happen if there was no dowry. In this particular marriage, what happened was, they said it was a part of the culture in this particular Madhura dynasty that when the daughter gets married, rather than giving gifts, they are meant to receive gifts. Now Bhishma, when he heard this, what did he say? Did he say, oh, this is deviation, I won't accept this? No, he said, I know about your tradition and I'm ready to honor this tradition because it is a part of the tradition. So I'm prepared. And he had brought lots of gifts to give. And basically the gifts that are given, they are expressions of affection. And that expression of affection will be commensurate with the financial and social status of the families. So if a family is very wealthy, then they will express their affection by giving many gifts. And if the family is not so wealthy, then they may access the affection by giving small gifts. And for example, in the Vedic culture, it is said, Atithi Devo Bhavo. That when the guest comes to our house, the guest should be honored, as if the guest is God. But it is described that if a person is very poor and cannot give anything, at that time the person can just offer a mat for sitting and offer some water for drinking and offer some words of appreciation, respect. And that itself is considered to be good enough reception. So the essential point is affection. So that affection and respect is expressed through the proper reception for a guest. And depending on one's level of opulence, one can express it in further ways also. But the essence is the expression and reciprocation of affection. So even in whatever way the marriage happened, and whichever direction gifts were given, whether they were from the female to the side to the male side, or the male side to the female side, the important thing was the reciprocation of affection. So Bhishma honored Madhuri by giving her family a lot of gifts. And then he brought Madhuri back. And then Madhuri was also married to Pandu as his junior queen. And then Pandu said that as Pandu was ruling, he was a very valorous prince. And he noticed that many of the kings in different parts of the world had started sliding towards unrighteousness. And not only were they defying the Kuru kingdom by not paying tributes regularly, but they were also defying the principles of dharma by themselves acting in adharmic ways and also allowing adharma to continue within their kingdom. So Pandu told Bhishma that you know, our dynasty's empire has now loosened its hold on the world. So he said, please give me your blessings and I will go around and conquer the world. So Bhishma was very happy to see this Kshatriya spirit in Pandu and he blessed him. And Pandu went with the army and he traveled all over the world. He challenged the warriors of the world. And seeing his heroism, his skills, his prowess, most of the warriors accepted, yes, the Kuru king is our master and we are willing to give tributes to him. Those who did not accept, Pandu fought with them and he defeated them. And then eventually when Pandu came back, you know, he came back with a train-like procession, a long, long, endless procession of chariots, horses, elephants, and so many other animals which were carrying the gifts which had been given by the various kings in tribute. And he came and bowed down to Bhishma, and Bhishma lifted him up and embraced him. And as he looked back at the heroic accomplishments of Pandu, as were evidenced from his getting all these tributes, but yes, true, this is a worthy heir for the kingdom. He's indeed a worthy king. So Pandu in this way proved to be a glorious Kshatriya. But at the same time, Pandu was not so interested in royal administration. So his mind immediately shifted from royal duties and he felt inspired to live simply near the forests. So he consulted with Bhishma and expressed his desire. And he told that in my absence, Dhritarashtra can act as the king and you can act as the protector of the kingdom, as you have acted in the past also. And I will go and live in the forest. So Pandu agreed. Pandu expressed his desire and Bhishma agreed. And Dhritarashtra in this way became the king in the absence of Pandu. And Pandu went near the foothills of the Himalayas and started living there. And now when he went there, his wives also went with him. His wives felt that although they were born as princes in royalty and they had been married into royalty, for them, royalty was not as important as loyalty to their husband. And they felt that if our husband is living in austerity, in simplicity, in a forest, then we will also live with him. Of course, the local tribals who were living in that area, they were honored that the Kuru king is coming and staying in our midst. And they were eager to serve Pandu in whatever way they could. And that's what they did abundantly. They served him and they provided him whatever requirements were there. And Pandu lived in the forest. He met with the sages and he would travel around, learn from the sages. And he also loved at that time to go into the forest and hunt. Now hunting is a part of Kshatriya culture. Although today from our today's sensibilities where we consider animal rights and we feel that why should animals be killed? And there is hunting is different from the slaughter of animals that happens for poaching purposes or for the meat packing industry. In poaching, the animals are killed purely for business purposes, so that maybe their skin can be taken out or in other ways they can be exploited. And of course, in the meat packing industry, in the slaughterhouses, the animals are sometimes artificially inseminated and grown in large numbers. They have to live in terrible conditions where hundreds of animals have to live in a space that is suited only for a few animals. They never get to see the fresh air, they never get to see the sun, they rarely get to move around freely. So that is a horrible way for animals to live, and then they are slaughtered. So this is entirely different, this is diabolical, this is demoniac. This has got nothing to do with the hunting in Vedic culture. The purpose of hunting were many. Firstly, one purpose was that in the forest, the sages would live. And when the sages are living in the forest, the sages rarely, they don't have any weapons for self-defense. The sages, when they go to the forest, they understand that the forest is a place for meditation without the distraction of the commercialism of the cities and the towns and even the villages. And they want to focus on transcendence. And the forests which are in Sattvaguna are conducive for transcendence. But the forests also have animals which are violent and ferocious. So to keep these forests safe for the sages, the Kshatriyas would hunt and kill the dangerous animals, the tigers, the lions. Now the tigers and lions also knew that there were areas in which they could live and they would be safe in those areas. And there were the hermitages of the sages in which the sages would live. And normally the tigers and the lions and other dangerous animals would not come in those hermitages. Because they knew if we come over here, then we will be attacked. Even the Kshatriyas will come and kill us. And normally these boundaries were maintained. And sometimes the way of nature is, especially in the forests, the animals will procreate and they will reproduce. And their numbers will become large. And when the numbers become too large, at that time, they can disrupt the balance in the nature. And especially they may populate into the areas where humans are living. And they may disrupt the human order. So the Kshatriyas would normally kill the dangerous animals, keep the number in regulation. But apart from that, they sometimes would kill other animals also to ensure that the numbers would not become too much. And the Kshatriyas were also aware of the natural balances. And they would take care of those balances. When the Pandavas were living in the forest, at that time, when they were living in a particular area for a good amount of time, for several years, so at that time Vyasadeva came to them and told them, don't stay here for too long. While you are staying here, you are hunting the animals over here, and the animals here will get wiped out. So now you move deeper into the forest, so that the balance is maintained. So sensitivity to the ecology was also there in the Vedic culture. And that was based on understanding of respect of nature and all the flora and fauna of nature. But respect does not mean that the Kshatriyas did not do their duties. As a part of their duty, they had to kill. So just as they had to kill human beings, they had to kill animals also, and they would kill. And not only would they kill for the sake of protecting the sages by killing the dangerous animals, for the sake of keeping the animal population under control, but they would also kill because they had to fight and keep the Kshatriya skills in tune. Now, we may say, do you have to kill someone to practice your skills? Can't, if they want to shoot arrows, can't they just shoot arrows at some target and they can practice that way? Yes, that is one way of practicing. But fighting of Kshatriya skills and exercising the Kshatriya skills doesn't mean just accuracy in shooting targets. That is one part. Along with that, another part is the capacity to see blood and gore and death without getting overwhelmed by it. Now, every occupation requires certain disposition. When a doctor is treating patients, and the patients are in great pain, the doctor naturally needs to feel sympathy for the patient, but doctor shouldn't get so overwhelmed by the patient's pain, a doctor loses the clarity of thought. A doctor won't be able to function. This is all the more so for a surgeon. A surgeon has to actually cut the patient's body. And how can the surgeon do that if the surgeon gets overwhelmed by seeing blood and pain and gore and flesh? So same applies to nurses also. So certain professions require certain dispositions where certain amount of sensitivity has to be put aside and clarity has to be maintained so that the duty can be done. So for Kshatriyas, they have to often fight in a dharma yuddha, in a righteous war, they have to fight and they have to kill. And when there is killing, there is blood and there is gore and there is screams and there is so much pain and death. And the Kshatriyas cannot get emotionally overwhelmed by that, but they have to stay grim and firm and fight. So that preparation for that is also a part of Kshatriya training. And for that, Kshatriyas shoot animals. And when they shoot animals, the live targets which they have, those targets, when they shoot them, moving targets, that gives them practice not just in terms of accuracy in hitting the targets, but also practice in terms of becoming desensitized, becoming sufficiently desensitized to the sight of blood and gore. So one day when Pandu was going around hunting like this, he was going around hunting various plains at various places, and before this he had begotten 5 children. We will discuss about these 5 children, the Pandavas, later when we talk about Kunti. But here suffice it to say that he had begotten these 5 children and they were growing up. But then one day he had gone to shoot and he saw a deer over there. And he just shot at the deer. And as he shot at the deer, the deer suddenly gave a great scream of pain. And the deer fell aside. And to Pandu's shock, he saw that the deer had transformed into a human being. Not just a human being, but a Brahmin. a sage. And then the Shidir got also transformed into a human being. Pandu was shocked. He says, what is this? What have I done? As he beheld the sage, the sage said, what have you done, O king? He said, I'm a Kshatriya, and a Kshatriya duty I shot and killed. It is my duty to hunt and kill. So the sage said, yes, it is your duty to hunt and kill. But it is not a duty of any Kshatriya to kill any creature when it is in the act of procreation. In the act of procreation, they are creating a new life. And at that particular time, the animal is completely, whenever a person is uniting, whichever creature it is, that is quite captivating. And the person gets completely absorbed in that person, whichever living being it is, not just humans. And at that time, the animal is not capable of running. And when the animal is not capable of running, at such a time when the animal is completely lost to the world, absorbed in that activity, cannot shoot and kill at that time. It's a very sinful activity. And Pandu heard this, hung his head in shame. He could not deny the truth of the words of the sage. And he said that Pandu started regretting. He said, wow, what possessed me? How did I, in the moment, throes of passion like this, how did I do such a terrible activity? And the sage became very grave. He said, you have done a very sinful activity, and therefore I will curse you. So Pandu looked up in horror. He knew that he deserved a curse, but still he was horrified at the prospect of a curse from a Brahmana. First of all, to assault a Brahmana or Kshatriya is unthinkable, and then to be cursed by a Brahmana is equally disastrous. So he looked up and hung in horror at the sage, and the sage uttered the curse. What that curse was and how that curse eventually materialized in the life of Pandu, we will discuss in our next session. Thank you. Hare Krishna.